celebrity. John received the letter in late February. Sitting on the couch in a patch of late afternoon sunlight, he read it and reread it. Dear Mr. Haskell, your old hometown has always been so proud of you. We are planning a town festival for August 1st of this year, an event sponsored by the local merchants, churches, and auxiliaries. I will supply details as they come together. But one thing we know for certain is that we will have a parade. Many people on the planning board think that you would be the perfect person to serve as Grand Marshal. We know it has been quite a few years since you visited Shorter. Perhaps this could be an opportunity for you to visit your former stomping ground and see old friends and classmates. We would like for you to participate in the opening ceremonies, ride at the head of the parade, and possibly be available for pictures and autographs, situation yet to be determined. At the moment, we do not have funds in our budget to offer you any honorarium or cover your travel expenses. I thought I should make that clear up front. That being said, we will continue to look for sponsors that might be able to help in that. We do ask that you give us an answer in the next 3 weeks so we can make alternate plans if necessary. Thank you for considering this, and we hope we'll see you at the head of the parade on August 1st. Sincerely, Rita McAfee, Chairperson, Festival Committee, Shorter, Missouri. John's wife, Tina, came in from the kitchen.
From the look on your face, I'd say that's an overdue bill or some bad news, Tina said.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe both, John answered with a sigh.
They've invited me to come back to Shorter to be in some damn parade, some festival they're having. There's a part of me that, you know, wouldn't mind visiting the place, and another part of me that knows I'll probably regret it once I do. You know, the old no good deed goes unpunished thing.
Do you have to make a speech or anything?
No, they just want me to be there for the opening and ride in the parade, sign some autographs maybe. But we'd have to pay our own way.
Well, a town that small, I'm sure they don't have a lot of money to throw around.
And they all think you're a millionaire anyway, Tina laughed.
Yeah, don't you wish? John sighed again.
We could do it. Give you a chance to see your brother. What's it been, a year and a half since they were here to visit us? Maybe this comes at the right time.
Yes, it would be good to see Kurt and Jane. I just didn't know it would require a parade. Let's think about it a bit, and I'll decide whether I want to endure it. But I got to give them an answer pretty shortly.
They thought about it. John answered, yes. They booked flights in May, Boston to Kansas City, round trip. Decided to rent a car, rather than have Kurt drive all the way to the airport to pick them up and take them back. Also, they could get out for a while if they wanted to, or needed to. The last day of July, they made the trip. John had consciously tried not to think about it the previous week. He knew it would just make him apprehensive and nervous, which it did. Going back to Shorter was usually good, but it was always a bit much. Too many memories to consider, too many names to remember. And then there was the baseball talk. If he just didn't have to talk about his baseball career, long over now, the visits might not be so exhausting. But people wouldn't give it a rest. They liked the idea that they knew somebody who knew somebody, always wanting to go over who he had met and who he had played with and against, and who was a jerk and who was a nice guy. And they always, always wanted to go over the abrupt ending, the injury, the cut.
And it was in the year before the team started their World Series streak.
Someone always had to remind him of that.
If only you'd...
If only. They arrived at Kurt and Jane's farm, the farm where the brothers had grown up, on Friday early evening. A new dog came running out to bark at the car. It looked a lot like the shepherd they'd had years ago. John had a flashback that gave him a small shiver. Behind the dog came Molly, who was noticeably taller than a year ago. What was she, 12 now? Kurt and Jane came out of the side kitchen door, smiling and tan and country written all over them.
I love these people, John accidentally said out loud.
Tina looked over at him and squinted, a small shake to her head. They got settled in, got all the small talk and news covered, had dinner. Mid-evening, John called Rita McAfee, the chairperson, to let her know he was in town.
Could you be down here in the morning about 9:30? The opening ceremony will start at 10. It won't last all that long, but I know people will be excited to see you, to know you're here. The parade starts at noon. I need you over at the schoolyard by 11:45 to get in the lead car to start the parade. Star Ford and Lincoln over in Cooperton is supplying a new convertible for you. Isn't that nice?
Rita's exuberance made John feel tired already. Will I be driving it myself?
No, sir. You'll be riding in the back, sitting up on the back seat so everybody can see you. I'll be your chauffeur. There'll also be a big old box of candy back there so you can throw treats to the kids. Or eat some yourself. Whatever you want to do. You're the guest of honor. Did you bring your baseball cap?
No, didn't know I was supposed to. And to tell you the truth, I don't much like to wear caps anymore.
Well, that's a shame,
Rita said bluntly.
Folks would have loved to see you in that cap. Jersey?
No, no cap, no jersey, no uniform or costume. I'm just gonna smile and wave. That'll have to be enough. It's just me, and I'll throw some candy if you want me to.
Suit yourself.
Rita had turned a bit chilly.
They would have loved to see you in your uniform again. Probably doesn't fit no more, does it?
I'll see you 9:30. And John hung up. Everyone turned in early, very early for John and Tina. John had hazy dreams of dogs and baseball games. At breakfast, Kurt told John that Rita had called again, just after 7, wanted him to bring pens and Sharpies to sign autographs. What, she thinks I travel with all that stuff, like I'm just signing autographs all the time? Jeez.
Don't worry about it. I know we got some Sharpies around here, Jane said. Not a big deal.
Little brother, if I didn't know better, I'd say you're getting butterflies about this.
And Kurt laughed. Man, nothing makes me as nervous as getting up in front of a bunch of people I've known my whole life, John said. Somewhere between an honor and humiliation.
Yeah, they both start with an H. So does hell and high water. Come on, you can do this. It'll make a bunch of people happy.
I guess I'll be trading mine for theirs. And John shook his head. Let's get it going.
Kurt rode into town with John and Tina. Jane said she'd come in a bit later with Molly. The drive was nice in the early morning. No heat, not much humidity yet. John rolled down the window. He remembered that sweet early morning smell of soil and moisture and animals. It took him right back to bus rides into school and crack of dawn work in the fields. That seemed like a very long time ago. But the smell was still the same. Still the same. Finally hitting the city limits, crossing the tracks, finding a parking place a couple blocks south of the downtown intersection, it started to hit him. Yeah, I don't live here anymore, and I haven't for a long time. Tina took his hand. Walking in, John saw that downtown Shorter only had a few vacant storefronts, and the grocery store had changed its name. Everything looked pretty good, he thought, but of course, smaller. It always looked smaller than he remembered, and smaller than the last time. I guess that makes me city, he thought. There were already quite a few people milling about. The little carnival, with its clanky rides and games and concessions, was set up around the corner from the bank, and other vendors and craftspeople were opening up booths along the street. John thought he saw this person and that person glancing sideways at him. He pulled up a few names and a few blanks as he saw familiar faces. Several people waved with an index finger and a, "Hey, John!"
"Well, looky! It's Mr. Baseball, Mr. Dodger, Mr. Big League's graciousness with his presence."
John heard the voice coming up behind him, but he knew who it was before he turned around.
"Hello, Lenny. How you doing?"
Lenny Steinbrecht was a couple years older than John. They had gone to high school together, had played some sports. Lenny was a little guy, but he was fast back then. He was a big talker, actually a loudmouth wannabully in high school. And apparently still was, at least loud. Lenny kept talking not really to John, but just kind of to the air around him and to anybody that might be within earshot of his high-pitched voice.
"Yeah, Mr. Centerfield, how's that baseball treating you?"
"Well, Lenny, it's been a few years, both for baseball and for you, but I'm doing okay. You?"
Oh, man, I got it going on. Fingers in a lot of pies, if you know what I mean. Yeah, you ain't nothing.
And Lenny walked on by, mumbling something about hot shit. What? John wasn't even sure he heard that right. Either way, it was not the way he wanted this to start or to go.
The opening ceremony's going to be down at the Fireman's Park by the library, Kurt said. We probably should get on down there.
John was happy to hear they still had a library. He guessed that was a good sign. There were a few chairs and a small sound system set up in front of the fountain at the Fireman's Park. The park was only a small corner of the block, with a fountain, some flower beds and shrubs, and a single bench in front of a flagpole. The mayor of Shorter, K.M. Ferris, the only person who was ever on the ballot, was standing by the fountain writing some notes in a spiral pad. Rita McAfee saw them walking up and waved excitedly in greeting, but she was holding something in her upraised hand, shaking it like a threat.
I found something for ya,
she sing-songed in a voice that was close to a taunt. As they got closer, John could see the Dodgers insignia on the cap that was crumpled in Rita's shaking fist.
I don't know if it's the right size. Probably not. I got it from somebody's kid. But it'll have to do, and you don't have to wear it too long, just for now, and during the parade. It'll look cute.
Her voice, and everything about her, said, steamroller. Oh, geez. Rita, I...
Just take the damn thing,
Tina side-whispered to John, cutting him off.
Just take it.
Well, try it on,
Rita said as she fluffed the cap open and presented it to John, a crown and a dunce cap.
Do it. Try it on.
John could hear his brother choking down a guffaw. John set the cap atop his head, where it perched like a thimble on an orange. Kurt's chuckles were louder now. Tina was smiling, but shaking her head. Thanks for going to the trouble, Rita, John said as he took off the cap and stared at the logo. I'll put it on when the service starts.
It's not a service. It's a ceremony,
Rita chopped.
We're dedicating a plaque to our veterans. Come on, time to sit down.
A small audience had gathered, but there were no bleachers or chairs, so Kurt and Tina joined the people standing in the street as John took a seat between Rita and the mayor. A few members of the high school band had assembled and were playing a march that John didn't recognize, but leaned toward the oompah. The march was brief and ended. The drummer hit a long roll, and a single trumpet started To the Colors. John could see in his mind his grade school class standing at attention by their desks as every school day began. He could smell his fifth grade teacher. Looking over his shoulder as he stood, John saw members of the American Legion, Post 551, it said on their garrison caps, raising the flag and saluting. Paunchy old soldiers who, for the moment, found their dignity. Rita leaned forward past the mayor and glared at John, narrowing her eyes and shaking her finger as she pointed to his head, then hers. John looked at her blankly, then turned away. The Dodgers cap stayed in his back pocket. The mayor read a poem and a few remarks about this wonderful day and the sponsors and the veterans. He read the inscription that would be on the plaque that would eventually be installed at the base of the flagpole when the engravers delivered it, but there had been a delay. He acknowledged John, so glad he could come home to be the Grand Marshal of the parade, and a few applauded. A high-pitched voice yelled,
"Play ball!"
from the back of the crowd. The band director stepped up to the microphone and sang a song about this proud land. A little more applause, and that was it. People wandered off in different directions. A few folks came up and spoke to John, so glad he came home for this. An older lady was standing at the back of the small group that was talking to the mayor. It took a moment, but finally John recognized her. Agnes Castor, his third grade teacher. Wow, she must be 100 years old now, John thought. He had never liked her much back in third grade. She was always so grumpy and mean to the poor kids. She threw a book at Pam Lawson one time, squarely striking her in the temple. And she had smacked John in the back of the head once. He didn't know then or now what for. One memory triggered another and another. She'd had a dog named Toby. At lunch, everyone in the class was required to put their food scraps into their empty cardboard milk cartons for her to take home to Toby. If a kid was caught not cartoning their scraps, Mrs. Castor would mercilessly humiliate them in front of the class. John wondered even then how one dog could eat so many scraps. The other possibility was... Agnes turned from the mayor's group and met eyes with John, like she knew he had seen her, like she knew what he was thinking. She came over to him.
"Well, Johnny, John, John, just look at you."
The same voice, just cracklier. It still gave John a slight catch, like he was about to get in trouble, about to get singled out. "Hello, Mrs. Castor. Well, it's sure been a long time." She stared straight into John's eyes, which made him look down.
"You were always one of my favorites, Johnny. Always one of the good boys. I knew back then that you'd make something out of yourself."
A space. A pause. Something rewinding. "Huh. Well, I'm glad you remember it that way, Agnes." It felt very strange to call her by her first name, and John thought he saw her flinch just slightly.
"You're glad I remember it that way. That way? Which way is that?"
She was the teacher again.
"How do you remember it?"
He started to, then he stopped. There's no need to do this. But he did. "I hated you." The words came out slow and dripping, shocking and involuntary. John almost said, "fucking hated you." But it came out even meaner, more real without that. Time got all tangled up, and John was not a grown man, and Agnes Castor was not an old woman for either of them. The steel in her eyes, the hardened expression, bridged the space and the years between them, and John took a step backward even before Agnes spoke.
"Well, you messed it up in the end, didn't you? I knew you would. You're part of this dirt here, no matter where you move to."
Then Agnes smiled, which was the worst thing she could have done. She slowly turned and walked away, nodding to people as she moved through the thinning crowd, her raised chin clearing a path ahead of her. Tina walked up and placed a hand on John's shoulder.
"Who is that?"
she asked. She noticed the sweat through John's shirt and felt the tightness in his muscle. "Oh, an old teacher of mine, third grade, Mrs. Castor." John took in a deep breath and let it out.
"She looks sweet. Was it nice to talk to her?"
"Yes. No, not really." John turned close to Tina's face. "I'm already regretting this and it's barely started. I've only turned over a couple of rocks and the snakes are already coming out." Tina could see the distress in John's eyes and knew it was real, not exaggerated.
"Babe, we knew this was possibly going to be a little weird, but it won't last long, and just think of all the people that'll be happy to see you."
"That's just the thing," John said. "I don't really think they are happy to see me. They think I'm some kind of joke, or they think they need to take me down a notch. I don't know how many notches I can spare today." Kurt came up beside them. "Well, we got a little over an hour before the parade starts. You want to get something to eat or something to drink? I think the Dove is open."
"Yeah, whichever," John said. "Let's just get out of the sun for a while. We're going to have plenty of it this afternoon. But I don't know, maybe dehydrating and fainting would be my best plan here. Waking up in an emergency room with an IV might not be so bad."
Kurt frowned. "You okay, little brother?" He turned to Tina.
"He okay?"
"Yes, I think so," Tina said. "Just a little too much collision of past and present."
John was about to ask Kurt if he had bad memories of Mrs. Castor. When he felt a hand on his ass, he reflexively swatted behind him pretty hard, but missed striking the hand of Rita McAfee, who was pulling the Dodgers cap out of John's back pocket.
"Mister, I went to a lot of trouble to get this darn cap for you, so I would appreciate it if you'd at least wear it when I ask you to. You said you would."
Tina stepped between them.
"He just forgot. I'll see to it that he wears it at the parade."
Tina leaned toward Rita ever so slightly, and Rita leaned back a matching amount.
"Well, okay then,"
Rita said, lowering her tone.
"Folks are expecting him to look like a baseball player, that's all."
And she flashed a brief, fake smile, then walked away.
People seemed to instinctively get out of her way just like they did for Agnes Castor. John started to object, but Tina cut him off.
I just didn't want you to hit her.
And her smile made John feel a little less alone in all of this. Thanks, babe. You've always got my back.
And your front and your sides and even your head, cap or no cap. Give me the damn thing.
And Tina put the cap on her own head. John thought she looked just right in it. The Dove Cafe was packed with all the extra people in town, but the waitress somehow got the three of them seated very quickly.
Looks like your celebrity hood still gets you to the front of the line at the finest restaurants, joked Kurt.
Yeah, that and a nickel. Seated and reading the menu, John decided on a pork tenderloin, even though he hadn't eaten red meat in over 3 years. Tina didn't say anything about that, and ordered the dinner salad, hold the lunch meat topping. Kurt had the wimpy burger and onion rings. They didn't speak much. It was so loud in the cafe that it was hard to hear across the table. As they finished their meal, the waitress handed John what he thought was the check. He turned it over, but it was a blank piece of paper. Where's the check?
Somebody over at the counter paid for your meal, but they asked that I not tell you who it was.
John looked over his shoulder at the people seated at the lunch counter, but no one was looking his way, at least not obviously.
Well, tell them I said thank you. So what's the paper for?
My grandpa was a big fan of your baseball team, and I wondered if you could sign an autograph for him. He'd get a big kick out of that. Could you make it to Toad?
Toad?
Yeah, that's his nickname. Nobody calls him Eldred. That's his real name.
So who is your grandpa?
Eldred Petrie, Toad Petrie. He said you'd remember him from back in the bailing days. He thought you had worked on one of his crews when you were in high school.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Petrie,
John said with a smile, even though he had no idea who the girl was talking about. You give him my best, and thank you for sneaking us in ahead of the line.
You got some dirty looks, but I wouldn't worry about it,
said the waitress.
Most folks are real glad you're here.
It was dusty and hot over at the grade school parking lot, the starting point of the parade. Kurt had stayed behind at the Dove to meet up with Jane and Molly. John and Tina wandered around looking for a convertible, figured it couldn't be that hard to spot. And there came Rita McAfee, clipboard in hand.
Over there! Over there!
Rita shouted, a bit louder than she needed to, and pointed emphatically. John could see a red car parked at the far edge of the lot, under some trees. And just beyond the convertible was a helicopter, glinting bright flashes in the sun as its blades turned slowly. Both vehicles looked distinctly out of place among the pickup trucks, antique tractors, classic cars, and horses that were assembling.
We might as well get in the shade, sit in the car until this starts, John said to Tina, and they headed across the lot.
He plucked the Dodgers cap off Tina's head and waved it in the direction of Rita McAfee, not knowing if she was looking, but figuring she probably was, already or still pissed off at John about the cap. As they got closer to the car, it became clear that this was not the new convertible that Rita had mentioned, sort of promised. This was almost a vintage car, but not quite, and certainly not restored, though someone was trying or at least thinking about it. The back panel was a noticeably different red than the driver's door. Walking to the passenger's side, the door and back panel were two different colors of primer, accented by spots of gray body putty. The retractable convertible roof wasn't there at all. Just the rusty metal frame collapsed into the space behind the rear seat. Taped to each door was a hand-lettered sign. John Haskell, Grand Marshal and former baseball player.
Wow, they didn't even spell your name right. And they could have left out the former, don't you think?
Tina smiled over at John, who did not return it.
I keep expecting someone to jump out and say, "Gotcha," John said. Like one of those prank shows or candid camera. But I guess the even bigger joke is that's not going to happen. This joke is getting a little too fucking real. And I'm both the only one who gets it and the butt of it.
You know, you can bail out on this whole thing, Tina said. We just go back downtown, find Kurt, and go back out to the farm or even head to the airport tonight. We could do that.
Yeah, and then I'd never be able to set foot here again. You think I'm a joke now? My name would truly be shit around here, and Kurt would have to hear about it forever.
You are not a joke,
Tina said. taking his face in her hands. This is just
small-town stuff. This is what happens here. It doesn't mean near as much as you think it does. Nobody's trying to humiliate you or make you look bad. It's just the best they can do. They really are proud of you, in their own backhanded way.
Tina took a breath and softened her voice.
Look, John, I know there are all kinds of layers to this for you, layers I can only partly understand. All the memories and expectations and old friends and such. But I'm here, and I know you, and I love you, and it'll be over soon. Like they say, we'll laugh about this later.
Then I wish later would hurry up and get here, John said. He was already feeling foolish and embarrassed that all this upset him so much.
Remember, you're just...
Tina searched for the right words.
You're just another float in the parade.
The lead car, the multi-toned old convertible, turned from Water Street onto Pine, headed for downtown. John was sitting on top of the back seat, holding on to the folded frame of the missing roof to keep from sliding or falling over, with Rita McAfee in the driver's seat, taking the corners a little too fast, and Tina in the passenger seat, glancing back at him. The Dodger's cap was in his lap. But for John's part, he barely felt like he was in the car. Torn scraps of sun filtered down, leaves of light blowing over him as the car moved through streets he had walked as a boy. He kept having the sensation that he was floating above the whole thing, viewing it not from the high back seat, but from near the power lines and the branches. There had been a few people along the route waving to him, or waving to someone in the car, but mostly he felt like he was invisible.
Huh, I'm a ghost floating above my own funeral procession, John thought. Well, at least I'm dead.
Rita's piercing voice brought him back to reality.
Mister, put on your cap. There's a bunch of people ahead.
Give me a break, Rita. I'm not going to wear it. It's way too small. It looks silly.
Rita, he's not going to wear it. I'm going to wear it.
Tina broke in, with just enough force to close the discussion. She took the cap from John's lap and pulled it onto her head.
Go, team!
Rita opened her mouth to say something, but Tina's smile, both cheerful and a warning, made her stop. Voices.
Hey, John!
Yeah, man! Woohoo! I know that guy! John! John! Over here!
More voices, more faces. The crowd was getting deeper, closer. Someone was applauding. The marching band started playing a song, several lengths behind. John smiled, and smiled again. Images caught in small glimpses, faces passing by for only a few seconds, just long enough for a shout and a recognizing smile and wave. Sometimes, surprisingly often, a name would rise in John's memory when he saw a familiar face, and he would shout back at them, a look of, "Wow, he remembers me. He knows who I am." John had expected this to be hellish, like rushing faces in a nightmare. But it wasn't. Simple as that, it wasn't. And it came to John that this was the transaction. This was all he needed to do. Let people know that he saw them, and that he remembered them. That's all they wanted. He could do that. During his time in the majors, John had been in several parades, many opening days and fanfares, signing autographs and posing for pictures. That was easy, if a bit repetitive, tiring, and boring. They were all strangers, and all he had to be was the baseball player, be the outfielder with the good batting stats, wear the uniform. When the uniform and the stats and the team were gone, then so was John. But here he was. He was here. No uniform, no easy part to play. He had to be himself, which was a much harder and more uncertain role. He had to tie it all together, who he had been growing up, who he had been with a bat in his hands, and who he was now, a much harder column to tally. But that argument, that struggle, was only with himself, a resolution only he could square. This moment, he didn't have to come up with an answer. He only had to be present, be the guy who went outside the city limits, the county line, the state, the guy they knew who knew somebody. In John's mind, the parade lasted hours. In reality, It was about 25 minutes. And, much to his own surprise, at the end of the parade when the car pulled to a squeaky stop in front of the post office, he found he was actually having a pretty good time, actually enjoying himself. John was directed to a small canopy tent with a table and some photocopy enlargements of his rookie year baseball card. There were Sharpies and a couple of pens.
"I need to get out of the sun for a while," said Tina. "I'm going to try to find Jane, get something to drink."
She took off the Dodgers cap and handed it to John, who put it in his back pocket.
"Do you want me to bring anything?"
"No, it looks like they've got some water for me over here." A few people were already lined up for autographs, and John was greeted with "howdies" and "how you doings." He took a seat behind the table and started greeting people and signing the photocopy sheets, asking them how they spell their first names when he couldn't quite remember who they were. A tall man in clean overalls was next in line. John did recognize him. Norman Clemens had been a classmate of John's, not really a friend, just one of those quiet kids whom John had spent 12 years of his life with, but really barely knew.
"Well, Norman, long time no see," said John.
And there was a pause as Norman just stared blankly.
"Do you want me to sign one of these old pictures?"
"You look different, John, and your voice sounds different."
"Well, it has been a few years since we've seen each other, Norman, but you look real good. I've put on a few pounds, but I don't think you have."
John took a safe guess.
"How's the crops this year?"
"They're doing all right." Norman kept staring. "You were always nice to me, John." This gave John a slight nudge of guilt, because he didn't remember being nice to Norman. He didn't remember being anything to Norman.
"Oh, we were kids, weren't we?"
And John knew that was meaningless, even as the words left his mouth.
"Hey, I've got a bunch of people waiting in line here, but it's good to see you, Norman."
"Watch yourself, John." And Norman left without picking up the signed photo. A few grade school age kids, some of the local business people who let John know they had sponsored this event, one of the local ministers, the line moved along. Then an older lady stepped up that looked vaguely familiar to John. She was pushing an infant in a stroller and had a toddler and a young boy behind her. Must be her grandkids. She had the look of someone who had worked out in the sun for too long. But it was the bowl-shaped haircut, streaked with gray, and the roughly chopped bangs that brought it back to John. Same haircut as kindergarten, all through grade school and into the first year of high school when she dropped out of John's class. Glenna Birdsong. As a kid, John always thought the name didn't fit her. Was from one of Shorter's very poor families. Upwards of 10 siblings in a house that looked like it couldn't possibly hold that many, with rumors that the chickens pecking in the dirt yard lived in there too.
"Hi, Johnny. Do you remember me?"
"Well, yes, Glenn, I sure do."
John realized these were probably more words than he had ever said to Glenna in the 8 or so years they were in school together. John started to say something about the kids, but didn't know whether to assume they were her children or grandchildren. But Glenna stepped into the space.
"This oldest one here is my boy, Johnny, just like you. And these two are my grandkids, Mikey and Rose. You got kids, Johnny?"
"Yes, we have one daughter, Elizabeth. We call her Bissy. She's traveling in Europe this summer."
And John wished he hadn't said that.
"Well, Johnny, I just wanted to say... I just wanted to say...
Glenna looked up into the air like she was reading skywriting.
"That you were shit to me back in school. Not so directly, but just part of the meanness that all you damn kids did."
Glenna spoke these words up to the air, but brought her eyes back down to John when she had finished. Then she smiled, but it was false. John looked down at the table, at his own false young face smiling up at him from the photocopies.
I'm sorry, Glenna. You're right. We were a bunch of cruel little shits, and I am sorry for that. I hope you'll forgive me."
"Well, I do not. I do not forgive you. You wouldn't need to be saying that if I hadn't walked up here to you. But I like festivals and events like this."
And Glenna suddenly became almost cheery. She smilingly surveyed all the activities around her and talked faster.
"I always seem to run into somebody that I get to tell that to,"
Glenna said, her eyes locking on John now.
"I've worked over at the nursing home in Cooperton for a long time now.
I was with your Aunt Helen when she died. You probably didn't know that, did you?
Glenna put on the false smile again.
No, of course you didn't.
Glenna took her granddaughter by the hand and walked away. The boy reached over and picked up one of John's photo sheets. He looked at it for only a second, then let it flutter to the ground as they disappeared into the crowd. Before John could even take in what had just happened, someone else was talking to him. Then someone else and another. He signed and smiled and shook a few hands. It was just blurry now. Rita McAfee returned, looking at her watch, which was on a small chain around her neck.
Well, mister, we got to get you and this tent cleared out of here. We're going to have some special events in just a little bit, and it's going to get crazy crowded. Did you have fun?
She didn't wait for John to answer.
So we are done with you, mister.
She held out her hand, then snapped her fingers twice. John didn't know what that meant. Then he did. He pulled the cap from his back pocket and handed it to Rita.
Well, that was a huge waste of time,
she said, and walked away, leaving John standing there holding a Sharpie. John looked around, not knowing where to go, feeling very conspicuous. He wanted to find Tina, but he needed to get out of the crowd, get some quiet and shade and privacy for a little while. The heat was just starting to make him feel panicky when he heard Tina calling to him from the opposite corner. Kurt, Jane, and Molly walked over with Tina.
Hey, John, man, how's the autograph session?
Oh, about like you'd expect. Mostly easy, but a few odd ones. Glenna Birdsong's message and her son's sad face flashed in his mind, and Norman saying, "Watch yourself, John."
We're wanting to go back to the house for a while, Kurt said. Get some real food and cool down before all the evening stuff starts. You coming with us?
Absolutely, said John. The afternoon at the farm was quiet, cool, and long. After a late lunch, John and Tina lay down in the small back guest room, the room that had been John's parents' bedroom while he was growing up, before Kurt and Jane had done the addition with the master suite. John could still smell his father when he opened the closet door. Sawdust and sweat. Through the wavy window pane, with a small crack in the corner, John watched the golden ripples of heat move over the fields and the far horizon. This was what John missed. The family was good, the townspeople were tolerable, but the eternity of the land was an empty space in John's landscape that nothing in the city could fill. He stared off, long and easy, knowing he wouldn't see this again for a while. John dozed off and had dreams of flying and falling and landing in a swimming pool that was full of his old friends and classmates. But they were all fully clothed and struggling to swim. No one could touch the bottom.
You were dreaming, Tina said as they roused. You said, breathe, breathe, a couple of times. What was that about?
Oh, I can't even remember, John said, although he did. Gathered around the kitchen table with the sun casting long rays, harsh and horizontal through the west window, Tina said that she was not feeling all that great, probably too much sun and that funnel cake. She wanted John to go back for the evening events, but she was going to stay at the farm. That way he could stay as late as he wanted without worrying about her. Jane and Molly had already headed back to town to get ready for the Too Tall, Shorter talent show.
Who thought up that name? John chuckled. What's it even mean?
Beats me, said Kurt. But at least it sounds funny.
Yeah, I'll give it that.
Say, you going to want to go to the beer garden after the show's over? Asked Kurt. Because if you are, I think I'll drive separate in the truck. I don't really care much for all the drinking, and the band's bound to be too loud for me.
Yeah, I probably will, said John. Too much of a good thing today, so it only makes sense to make it way too much. No good deed.
Goes home without a headache.
Tina finished. Really, John, you should go see the show and stay for the beer garden. See all your old friends. You'll regret it if you don't. Might be your last chance for a long time.
Regret it if I don't and regret it if I do. Just hard to tell which one will be bigger.
Kurt hit the shower and left in the pickup about 30 minutes later. John decided to pass on the shower.
I'm going to feel and smell exactly the same in about 10 minutes, he told Tina.
Driving into town in the rental car, John decided he really didn't much care to see the talent show, too tall or not. So he had some time to kill.
Turning off the blacktop onto one of the small gravel roads, John pulled the car over to the narrow, weedy shoulder and killed the engine. Opening its door, sitting there with his shoes in the dust, there was that smell again. Things decaying, things growing, animals eating and shitting and waiting to reproduce and to be slaughtered. Faintly, in smell and sound, railroad diesel moving it all along. At the growing dusk and into the night, there was another layer added to the smell, something older that John couldn't quite name, way down at the bottom. John had left, but the smell never did. He knew it smelled like that, whether he was there or not. He was beside the point. John could see the whole town from here. Geez, it was small. He could stretch out an arm and touch both ends of it with extended finger and thumb. The water tower, like a friendly old robot, looked down in sunset silhouette, as it had for decades. They were going to tear it down next year, Kurt had told him, replace it with one of those turkey baster designs. John figured no teenagers would be climbing up that thing to tell the world who they loved. Looking behind him in the opposite direction, there were the hills. This land didn't produce like the richer ground of the river bottom, but goddamn, it was beautiful. He knew that beauty would be lost on his Boston friends. It wasn't dramatic like the mountains, or threateningly eternal like the ocean. No, there was a quieter beauty here. You had to listen for it, really. But once you heard it, you knew it was a beauty that wasn't meant to be shared. There was just enough of it for one person at a time. Try to point it out to someone or tell someone about it, and it dissipated like it was never there to begin with. You had to be okay with that secret. Even from this distance, John could hear the sounds of the carnival music and a voice over a loudspeaker, too faint to understand. Lights were coming on here and there, and eventually car headlights washed over the edges of the tree profile. Across the darkening fields, beams moved like boats on a calm sea. Chesapeake of dirt, the words combined randomly in John's wandering mind. Checking the time, John saw that he'd been sitting there for nearly an hour, touching on this memory and that one, friends and girls and music and cars and beer and pot, visits home from college, life getting serious so gradually that you didn't even know what was happening to you. And baseball. God, he had loved baseball. God, he fucking hated baseball. That thought snapped John, shook him back to present tense. Time to head into town, get through the rest of this ritual. Driving in was like leaving a warm bed with an open window, feeling a rock in your shoe that you can't get to at the moment, wanting badly to brush your teeth, just growing discomfort. John passed several good parking spaces, stopping the car way down on 2nd Street, farther away from downtown than he needed to be. What he needed was the long walk in to get himself in the right mind to deal with people. As he got closer, a few folks were coming from the opposite direction. The talent show must be over. The different sidewalk streams of people were all converging tributaries into the arched entry gate of the beer garden. The city marshal, ancient Albert Oakley, still proudly wearing a badge and an old-style 8-point cop cap, was sitting in a high booth, supposedly checking IDs. But he was pretty much just greeting everyone and waving them on in, even a few young people of questionable drinking age.
"John Haskell, I remember chasing after you on a Halloween night," old Albert said. "Gonna go to jail sooner or later," he laughed.
"Yeah, and you caught me too. Sorry for the trouble, Albert. I've tried to reform."
"I think you've done all right, John. It's good to have you back. You have a good time tonight, you hear? But I'll be watching you, don't think I won't."
John genuinely smiled and walked on in. "That was about the nicest exchange I've had with anyone so far," he thought to himself, and shook his head ever so slightly. A young country band was already cranking up. "Fence Menders," it said on the bass drum. They were playing a haphazard version of a current country hit, something about her on a tractor in tight jeans and boots, and Grandpa thrown in there for good measure, and how the singer was heart-busted. Yeah, aren't they all, John thought. He scanned the picnic tables, looking for, well, he didn't know what, a place to sit, he guessed. Several people nodded greeting to him as he inched in, the occasional, "Hey, John." Finally, and surprised,
He saw Kurt standing up at a back table, waving him over. John edged his way through the crowd, keeping his eyes on Kurt and waving back, so as not to have to talk to anyone.
"I thought you weren't coming," John said.
"I probably won't stay long, but I thought, what the heck? Jane and Molly went on back. You missed a good show."
Kurt seemed to know that John had no intention of going. Kurt was sitting with a couple old classmates John recognized, and several others he didn't. They scooted together and made a space for John at the end of the bench. Lively talk, sometimes shouting, ran through old times, old teachers, new jobs and divorces, kids and a few grandkids.
"I'm still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up,"
one of Kurt's classmates said. Cheap beer in plastic pitchers and red cups sloshed around with the fragments of conversation. Frequency of curse words rose as the beer disappeared. John saw him, coming across the concrete slab that served as a dance floor. He shouldered a couple people out of his way, not intentionally, but his zigzag path made it unavoidable. Russell Blessington was big, always had been. He was from Dawson, the next town over, and back in high school, John had played against him in basketball and baseball. The two had gotten to know each other outside of school during their junior and senior years, when they both had cars. They had become friends of sorts, but were always competitive. John hadn't seen him in years. Russell came to a slow stop in front of John and just looked at him.
"Hi, Russell."
Russell kept staring.
"Hello, John,"
he finally said. His voice was soft, vulnerable even. John had braced himself for something more boisterous and aggressive.
"Russell, man, it's good to see you."
And John meant that.
"Hey, can I talk to you, like, over there?"
Russell pointed shakily back across the empty part of the lot, toward the orange tempo fence and the alley.
Where?
John asked.
"Come on, just follow me."
John looked over at Kurt, who shrugged.
"I'll be right back,"
John told him and let out a breath. John followed Russell to the fence, where Russell just stepped on it, tearing the staples off the thin wooden post, smashing the plastic fence to the ground.
"Can't we just talk right here?"
John said, not following Russell over the fence. Russell grabbed John's shirt sleeve and gave him a yank, almost knocking him over.
"What the fuck, Russell? What are you doing?" "We can't talk in there. I hate that music and I can't hear shit."
"Come on, man, I'm not going any farther. Let's talk right here." But John stepped on over the broken fence.
"You afraid Albert's gonna arrest us for vandalism?"
Russell laughed, deep and drunken.
"I doubt he can see this far anymore,"
John laughed with Russell, echoes of boyhood bouncing off the backsides of the old brick buildings across the alley. Russell started talking, loud.
"Man, I could have done it. I could have done what you done. I was better than you, and I was faster, and I was stronger, and I could hit that ball."
Russell reared back and did a slow-motion swing and pointed into the phantom outfield.
"Yeah, man, I was good. Wasn't that good, John?"
"Well, hell, Russell. I didn't expect you to just jump into that old shit. I mean, why? What's going on with you?"
"I guess that's just it. There ain't nothing going on. But I could have done it, man."
The nearly full moon eavesdropped through the thin clouds, and a dog barked over by the tracks.
"Yeah, but you didn't, Russell."
And Russell shot John a look, a dare.
"I mean, it gets real complicated after high school. There's so many things out of your control, so many things that are just up to chance and circumstance."
"That's what they ought to call that fucking graduation march, chance and circumstance."
"But I was good, Johnny."
Russell's voice was soft again, a hurt kid hiding there. Another dog barked an answer in the west distance.
"Hell yeah, you were good," John said. "I was terrified every time I played against you. Seemed like somebody always got hurt when they faced off with you."
John searched for explanation.
"But after that, it gets real complicated. It starts out being about where you go to college and who your coach is and who he knows and who owes him a favor. And then, when the pros start, whew, that is a mind fuck. What are they looking for? What do they think you can do? It's like they're buying a horse or just cattle.
Then money gets involved and you can't even keep up with it. It just becomes keeping your head down, staying in shape, don't get hurt, and don't think about anything else. When Tina and I were first together, we barely saw each other.
You know what you sound like, John?
Russell grumbled.
You sound like an ungrateful, high horse prick.
John sat down on a concrete block behind the liquor store. Yeah, I probably do, and I probably am. But you know, things from a distance aren't always what they seem when you get up close. It didn't go or end the way I thought it would. When I got hurt, Roger Lamont, that same son of a bitch that runs the team now, he told me that they'd take care of me, that they'd stick with me, buy me the time it took for me to heal up and get back in playing shape. Then just a couple weeks later, I get mailed a memo, a fucking memo, of the current roster and the current cuts. And you know what list I was on. Lamont didn't even call me. I had to read about it. Russell was staring off into the darkness, in the direction of the dogs barking. John wasn't sure he'd even been listening.
You know what we need to do, John? We need to go to a baseball game together in Kansas City. I could drive up and meet you there, have a good old time. You could give me all the inside scoop of what's going on down there.
Russell, man, I don't watch baseball.
Not even the World Series?
What do you mean you don't watch baseball?
I mean, I can't watch baseball.
My idea of hell is sitting in the stands next to Joe Beer and having people hoot and holler around me, barely paying attention to what's going on down on the field. There's a part of me that's still interested in the game, but I can't watch someone else do it.
Didn't you even watch the series when your old teammates were playing in it?
Russell seemed baffled. I'll tell you the truth, and you probably don't want to hear it, but I was rooting for them to lose every damn game.
Man,
Russell said, and that was all. Something they don't tell you, something you can't know until you get to the other side of that line, is that when you take something that you just love as a kid, and you stick with it, and you're lucky enough to do it for a living at some point, well, there's a price tag on that. And that price is, it isn't fun anymore. It can't be. You can't ever do it or watch it or even think about it for just the enjoyment anymore, which is like God's joke or something. Yeah, I'll give you this, but I'll make you hate it eventually. And when luck finally takes you down, that just adds to it. Chance and circumstance.
Dum, dum, de, dum, da, da.
Russell started singing. And John laughed sadly. Come on, let's get back in there. Kurt's going to wonder what happened to me. Russell turned to John with half-closed eyes and a queasy smile, then swung a fist hard, just barely catching John on the chin.
What the hell, Russell?
And John held his jaw.
Come on, let's go drink some beer.
And Russell headed off, back through the broken fence. John just stood there, shaken and mad.
Fuck you. Fuck you, Russell.
But Russell was long gone.
Fuck this whole thing.
John walked away down the alley, trying to figure out where he had left the car. The alley took him by the backside of the post office, the billiards hall, and the bank, all three of them looking dingy and crumbling in the purple-yellow glow of the streetlight. The alley ended at the base of the water tower, which also showed its age and deterioration. Rusting rivets and struts visible even in the dim light. The cage door that was supposed to cover the access ladder was on one busted hinge, and the lock was lying on the ground.
And what the fuck do you want?
John spoke to the ladder. He stepped under the access cage, looking straight up into the disappearing converging lines of the ladder, then pulled himself up the first long expanse, began to climb. John started to sweat a bit as he ascended, and the cooling night breeze chilled his skin. He didn't look down, ever. Just rung after rung, mechanical climbing until he reached the top. He had been up here once when he was a senior in high school and had watched J.W. Van Doy spray paint the call letters of a Kansas City radio station big as he could reach across the gray face of the tower.
Of all the damn things you could write, why in the world did you write that?
John had asked J.W.
I don't know. Couldn't think of nothing else,
J.W. had answered. At the top rung, John slid out on his belly onto the narrow metal mesh ledge that circled the tower. It was narrower, and the railing was lower than he remembered.
Oh, Lord,
John said in a breath. He lay there for a couple minutes while he got control of the vertigo and the sheer terror of the view. Wow, also higher than he remembered. But it was a view, a truly breathtaking view. And John held his, afraid to let it out. After a while, he pulled up into a sitting position and took it all in. The streetlights far below linked into an even formation of fireflies that thinned and faded out at the edges of town. A very few, car headlights moved between the glowing dots, disappearing and reappearing under the trees. Past the dark edge of town, out on Highway 10, a single wedge beam moved with speed. Motorcycle or one-eyed driver, John wondered. The country band playing at the beer garden was a far-off radio station, drifting in and out. It all looked and sounded so what? So lonely, John thought. The dark sky merged with the horizon, here and there defined by a soft glow that John could only see if he looked to the side of it. Rods and cones, the random words ran through his head. John found his courage, or maybe just forgot it altogether, and stood up, putting his hands on the low rail, gazing long and hard into the dark sky and all the stars beyond, across the past, present, and future. He pointed out into the black nothing for moments, then tapped the plate and took a long, slow-motion swing for the far wall. That one is out of here, folks. Out of the park. Clean out of town.